Welcome to Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Happy to have you with us today. Diana Althoff is back with us. She recently retired as the UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. And we're going to start off by talking about what to do if you find diseased leaves and plants in your yard. But of course, we can take your other garden questions also. So give us a call, 800-642-1234. And you can send an email, and that address is talk@wpr.org. Diana, so good to see you.
Hey, Jill. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Always a pleasure. So you wanted to talk a little bit about we as observant gardeners are always, you know, we tend to panic a little bit when we see spots and blotches and whatever on our plants. What should we know before we panic?
That's a great word to use. You know, I even though I'm not in the office yet or anymore, you know, I still talk to a lot of people and see a lot of online things and stuff. And it's been a tough year for our gardens. You know, last year we suffered through the drought and we had challenges with that. And this year it's been this constant rain, and constant rain promotes constant disease, especially fungal diseases that need that water around. So we have a lot of spots and specks and blotches and stuff going on. And you know, it's tough to know what to do about it. And one of the things, as you said, is don't panic. So just a little plant physiology review. Okay, so plants get their food, their energy through photosynthesis that's done in the green leaf tissue, and but nature knows stuff is going to happen to those leaves. And, you know, deer will chew them off, rabbits will chew them off, diseases. That's all part of the cycle. So the plants make a lot more green leaf tissue than they absolutely need. And so if you're getting a few specks or spots, or the insects have eaten a little bit of it, it's probably not going to affect your plant other than it's cosmetic. So it bothers us a whole lot more than it bothers the plant. I remember way back, quite a long time ago, seeing a research study on potatoes in Colorado. Potato beetles growing up in Plover in the Central Sams area of Wisconsin. You know, potatoes are everywhere. Sure. And they would do a lot of crop dusting and stuff to control beetles and that. But anyway, the research study showed that the beetles and the beetle larvae could eat a third of the leaf tissue before there was any loss of production in the actual pounds of potatoes per plant. So a third of the plant before there's any effect at all. So keep that in mind. If you've got a few specks or spots or holes in the leaves, it's not going to hurt the root of the plant. Now, obviously, that's a problem if it's lettuce that you want to eat, right?
True.
But if we're talking about, you know, trees and shrubs and perennial flowers and stuff, just don't panic about it. And then the other thing is, you know, we have heard, and rightly so in many cases, that, oh, you should remove the diseased tissue when you see it so that it doesn't spread. And there's truth to that, but there's also a limit to that. So that's one of the reasons why we really recommend that you know what disease it is that you're dealing with before you do a one-size-fits-all treatment. You know, sending a sample into the disease diagnostics lab and figuring that out is important, because a lot of our fungal diseases, they happened back in May and June. So the fungal spores landed on the leaves, the tissue was wet from the rain, the fungal spores germinated, they got into the leaf. It takes several weeks before that leaf tissue collapses and turns into a brown spot. And now, you know, normally by now anyway, the rain kind of has stopped. The leaf tissue is more mature, so it's less susceptible or whatever. So the disease is not progressing. So in that case, it's not really a big concern. But what you don't want to do is, as I mentioned, those leaves, that's the food factory for the plants. That's where they get their energy. So if you've got a leaf that's totally yellow, totally brown or whatever, it's not green anymore, it's not doing anything for the plant, of course, remove it, right? But if you've got a leaf that just has a couple of little specks or spots on it, if you remove it, you're actually removing the food factory for that plant. So I've seen some people saying that, oh, I removed all the, you know, I was getting these spots and I removed all the leaves with spots on them and now the plant looks really bare. Well, that's not a good thing, because now that plant is going to have to go down to the root system to get energy that it had stored there, because it doesn't have leaves, enough leaves around to be doing photosynthesis and storing energy. So there's a balance there. And, you know, generally speaking, I would say if there's green leaf tissue on the plant, kind of leave it there. The plant needs that. Unless if you think the disease is progressing and progressing quickly, that might be, you know, a signal that, well, maybe I should remove some things. But you still never want to remove more than a third of the leaf tissue, or you're hurting the plant more than the disease is. And if you have something that's really progressing and stuff, seriously, get it tested and stuff to know what you can. If you've got a whole plant that's wilting and everything's turning, well, that's probably a root problem. You know, that's not anything to do with the spots and stuff. But back to your word, panic. It is, you know, especially you put so much time and effort into these plants, and then, you know, nature comes in. But at this time of year, I don't think you could find a plant that doesn't have at least some blemishes of some kind. And that's just nature. That's just all part of it.
It's all part of it. I like that. That's sage advice, Diana. Now, what about if it's like, well, for instance, my favorite rose bush, of course, is being visited by Japanese beetles. I'm doing my best to keep them off, but they still have eaten a lot of those leaves. Now, should I take those off or should I leave them on?
Yeah, I wouldn't, with Japanese beetle, I'd take the beetles off, yes, but not the leaves. If there's a half of a leaf there, it's still doing photosynthesis, so leave it there. And that is the approach with Japanese beetles. And I'm sure right now there are 1,000 people across Wisconsin picking off their phone with their particular Japanese beetle question, because it's one of the most common problems. But with Japanese beetles, again, we have to take a limit the damage approach to them, because you'll never get rid of all of them. They will chew holes and eat your leaves and stuff. And that's the approach when we say go out in the afternoon and pick them off, dump them into soapy water, because you're just trying to limit the amount of feeding. And if you can limit the amount of feeding and they only eat a third of your leaves off, your rose bush is going to be fine. It's going to come back next year just fine. All of those, you know, issues come into play there and stuff. So we have to, you know, it's hard sometimes, but we have to tolerate that damage, because we're going to stress ourselves too much if we worry about every little hole.
That's right. Absolutely. We did get an email from somebody that's kind of along this line. Kristen Appleton, she has a question about an evergreen bush. She realized this year that it's covered in white spots that she thinks is pine scale. Now, it's damaging a large part of the bush, and she plans to remove the bush, I'm assuming. In her yard, they have another small pine tree, and her neighbors have some larger, well-established evergreens. Now, they don't seem to be affected yet. Should she be concerned? And how can she dispose of the bush safely?
There are a couple of things that will be white and stuff and bother pine trees. So first question is whether or not it's going to spread depends on if the neighbors and your other plants are the exact same species. So it's first, you know, we have to identify, is it truly a pine versus a spruce versus a fir or something like that? And sometimes that common word of pine refers to all kinds of evergreens and stuff, because these insects are usually very species specific. So whereas Japanese beetles are not species specific, they'll feed on 300 different kinds of plants. Most of these other things only eat a certain thing. And so whether or not it'll spread depends on if those trees are also in its food range. Mm-hmm. They are hard to get rid of, any kind of a scale or something, because what they're doing is they're sucking the sap out of the needles, and they very often have some kind of a waxy coating. That's what makes them look white, so that pesticides don't get into them and stuff. So usually the cure is something systemic that you like pour on the ground, and the root system is taken up by the roots and gets in the plant, so that when they drink the sap, it kills them. But if she's looking to remove this plant anyway, once you chop that plant off at ground level, it's going to stop taking up water and it's going to dry out. And then there's no sap there for these insects. So it's not a problem for disposing of it, because those insects are going to die once they're not getting food out of that working tree. So not a concern in this case, as far as disposing of them goes. Whether or not it's going to spread is, again, identifying the other plants. And even, you know, a lot of times they don't spread just because these particular insects, they have to get into an adult stage where they can move from tree to tree, whereas most of them are just in their little shell eating things. And sometimes we have no explanations for why they bother one plant and not another.
Right. What about other, you know, we're talking about diseased leaves and whatnot. I would imagine it depends on the disease, but is that safe to compost, or do we need to bag it and throw it, or what do we do?
That's a really, really great question. And that's one that is specific to the disease. So if it's something, and it's also specific to how you compost, okay? So let me explain aster yellows, because this is popping up a little bit. So aster yellows is a phytoplasma. It's an organism that actually gets into the vascular system of the plant. And it's most commonly seen on purple coneflowers. That's where it's popping up right now. But there's actually ash yellows that affects ash trees, that also affects some lilacs, and it causes weird symptoms. So with the purple coneflowers, it'll cause the purple petals to be green instead of purple. It'll cause like stacked flowers, like flower heads stacked on top of each other, and it'll cause like really feathery foliage and stuff on it. And it's spread by leaf hoppers. So it's an insect that sucks the sap out of the plant. And they actually like blow up from Texas every year. They don't really even overwinter here. But wherever they land, they can, if they have the organism in their little leaf hopper body and they stick their mouth into your purple coneflower, they can infect that plant. And once it has it for good. There's no cure for it, but it doesn't spread from plant to plant unless it has a leaf hopper spreading it. Okay. So it has to be spread by a leaf hopper. So we recommend that you remove that plant and get rid of it, because it can serve as a source if the leaf hoppers are hopping around. But you can certainly throw that plant on your compost pile, because once that plant is wilting and dying on your compost pile, there's no leaf hopper that's going to be interested in it. Okay. So in that case, it doesn't matter. If it's a disease that's an airborne disease, that the fungal spores blow in the wind, that kind of a thing, then if you hot compost, so you put on your compost pile and you're sure that your compost pile gets heated up to the 140 degrees and then you turn it, that sort of a thing, in most cases, it dies from that, okay? Now, if it's a soil-borne fungus, like the tomato, early blight tomato diseases that we have, the Septoria leaf spot and that sort of a thing, then we are a little more cautious about putting on your compost. If you do a really thorough hot compost, you can kill it off, but you know how many of us get out there.
I know.
So do we want to take that chance? Well, maybe not. And in that case, you can either burn it if you can burn in your area, or you could dig a deep hole like a foot down and bury it down there. It'll just rot away and it, you know, never see the light of day again. So you can do that. The ones that we get a little more cautious about are things like Hosta virus X. These viruses are just like little hard protein coats, and they don't die in compost well, and they can be spread by mechanical means and stuff. So when it gets to something like that, we really kind of say, you know, tuck it away in your garbage or something like that. And then the other one is late blight. So late blight, we haven't had it yet in the state. It's a year-to-year thing. It doesn't really overwinter here because it has to overwinter on live material, but that's what causes tomato and potato stuff. So the, you know, the big Irish potato famine and stuff. But that usually comes in later summer. So, you know, maybe in a couple of weeks, it might be showing up. They monitor that really well. So you can find out if it's around, it blows in the air, but it, because it's such a serious disease, it will, like if it gets in your garden, it will kill off your tomatoes, like in 4 or 5 days, they'll just collapse and stuff. And in that case, we usually recommend bagging those up, putting it in the hot sun for a few days and putting it in your trash, because that's a really economically serious one. So okay. The short answer to your question is it depends.
It depends.
Right. And that, again, that's why it's really important to try to figure out exactly what the diseases.
That's right. So make sure you either look it up on the internet or what have you, or send something to Brian Huddleston over at the UW Diagnostic, our Disease Diagnostic Lab. If you just Google that, he'll pop up. I believe he does have a small charge for that, so they can keep these things going, but at least you'll know what you're dealing with. So, all right.
And it's especially if it's something soil-borne, like there's verticillium wilt that gets into the soil and that will kill off your tomatoes. It'll kill off maple trees and stuff like that. If there's something like that, you want to know it because it makes a difference in what you can replant in that soil.
Okay, we're talking with Diana Alfuth. She's recently retired as a UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. Do you have gardening questions on your mind? Give us a call, like Christina and Glenwood, who will we get to in just a second. Our number is 800-642-1234, and you can also send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up at, let's see, I can't say 12:30 because this is Friday, but I just did, so if it's Saturday, it's going to be a little later. But we're going to be taking a look at creating and caring for rock gardens. But right now, we're taking your general gardening questions, and we're going to go to Christina in Glenwood. Thank you so much for being patient, Christina. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you. I have a 13,500-square-foot equestrian center, and it has black plastic with the river rock surrounding the entire facility, and part of it even comes out 10 feet to the driveway. Sadly, it is full of weeds now, and I have back issues, so I'm not able to pull, and I do not want to use Roundup. Have you got any suggestions at all? It just looks sloppy.
Oh, goodness, that's a big space.
It is. And being that I also have horses, I really, you know, like want to help you. So that's a great reason why, you know, the black plastic and rock, a lot of times people put in because they think it's lower maintenance. And it might be for the first couple of years because that black plastic keeps weed seeds that were in the soil from sprouting. But over time, soil and dust and leaves and everything land on top of those rocks. They break down, they fall down between the rocks, they sit on top of that black plastic, and it's a great place for weed seeds to germinate. And then you have this mess. So I don't know. Do you have plants in this area or is it just rock?
No, it's just the rock.
Okay. So that actually makes it a little bit easier. So if you don't want to use an herbicide, Roundup or whatever, to spray these weeds and stuff, what you can try to do is just smother that stuff out. So if you go out there and, you know, I mean, this is a big area, I get it. So you might have to do it in chunks. But if you got like a whole bunch of like more black plastic and put it over those weeds that are in those rocks and just leave it on there for the rest of the summer, because there won't be any sunlight getting to those weeds and stuff, they will die off. It'll take a while. And then of course their little weed, I mean, that's going to add to the compost that's, you know, down between the rocks and stuff, but at least you can clear out the mess that's there at the, at the time. And then, you know, it really is going to continue to be a problem every year. More, you know, this is going to happen every year where stuff's going to sprout in there. So this is where maybe it's better to find somebody with a skid steer and stuff who can come and, you know, remove that rock and stuff. But your options are pulling them, which is almost impossible because those roots often punch through that black plastic and they don't come out anyway. Spraying them with an herbicide like glyphosate or smothering them out, like with more black plastic or something that will block the light getting to them. That's all I can think of.
Yeah, it's not a great situation. Do you have suggestions on what would be a good way? Is it possible to put something down and put rocks over and just try to keep it rocks?
It doesn't work because rocks, because light goes down in between the rocks. Even if you have rocks that are 6 inches deep, light still gets to the bottom. And if a seed gets down there, which it will, and has soil contact or compost contact or dirt contact, it will germinate. So that's why we usually don't recommend the rock mulch option, but instead we recommend wood mulch. So if you put 4 inches of shredded wood over the soil, it will smother out the weed seeds, and then you just add more mulch every year. So, I mean, it's also, since you're not trying to grow anything in there either, I guess technically one option would be to just cover all these rocks with like 6 inches of wood mulch, and that you'd have to like mow off all the weeds that are there now, right? You know, like weed whack them off to rock level, and then put, you know, 6 inches of wood mulch over. That would do the smothering that the plastic otherwise would be. And then, you know, you like next year you might, like with any wood mulch, you sometimes get some weeds that germinate in it, but they're easy to pull out because it's so
loose. And loose. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if you're not interested in planting something in there, I guess then down below you have a buried layer of plastic, a buried layer of rock, and then you have wood mulch on top that you would have to replenish like every couple of years because it will decompose. So one way or another, you know, the whole situation doesn't just go away.
No, there's no easy solution, unfortunately. Christina, it's probably not the answer you wanted, but at least you have a few options. So
it's either that or having, you know, if you have like teenagers that need punishment for something and you can make them go in and pull all the weeds.
Yes, there you go. Good luck with that, Christina. Let's go to Guy in Madison. What do you got for us, Guy?
I have these dwarf nine-bark shrubs. I think they might be little devil nine-bark. And they've got the white fungus.
Oop, Guy, you still there? I think we lost him. Sorry about that, Guy.
Okay.
But he said
but
he has
what he's asking about.
White fungal disease, yeah.
Yeah, and that's powdery mildew. And the nine-barks are very, very susceptible to it. So little devil in... what's the bigger one that it was? Diablo nine bark was the bigger one. They're the burgundy leaved nine barks and they're great shrubs and stuff, but they are very susceptible to powdery mildew. And powdery mildew is a fungus, but it's a little different than most fungi because most fungi want leaves to be wet and then the spores germinate in that water that's on the leaves. Powdery mildew doesn't necessarily love it wet. But it likes hot, humid conditions. And there are lots of different strains of powdery mildew. Lots of different plants get it, like phlox and cucumbers and lilacs and ninebarks. But every one is a slightly different strain. But if you have a powdery mildew, you know you've had the correct conditions for all the powdery mildews. Once you're seeing the white stuff on the leaves, it's really like too late to do anything about it. Most plants, it's cosmetic, Okay, so the sunlight still goes through those leaves and does photosynthesis, so it just kind of looks ugly to us. Nine barks can get it bad enough that you can get like tip dieback and shoot dieback and that sort of thing. It's not likely going to kill your whole shrub, but you might get some dieback if you have it bad enough. The thing with fungi is that fungicides, no matter what kind of fungicide you use, they're preventatives, not curatives. So by the time you see the fungus, it's kind of too late. So my first advice is to say that your little devils are going to get this every year. And so be prepared for it. So maybe about mid-June or whatever would be the time to start putting some kind of a fungicide protectant on before the disease takes hold. Once it's there and it's white, you'll see all kinds of recommendations, you know, out on social media and stuff like milk and this and whatever. And while if you spray that on, it will take away the white, so it looks like it cured it, but it really didn't because it's just kind of collapsed that white fuzzy enough, but the disease is still there. Okay. So there is a homemade, you can get commercial fungicides that will control it. Okay, so you just go to your garden center, just read the labels, find one that controls powdery mildew, follow the label instructions. There is a homemade remedy that has baking soda, a little bit of horticultural oil, and you need that oil in there. You can use like canola oil if you can't find horticultural oil, and it's not dormant oil, it's horticultural oil. It's really, really lightweight. But if you don't put that oil in there, it doesn't work as well. And then water, and you spray that on the leaves. And that is not 100% effective on powdery mildew, but pretty good. So that would be your easy homemade remedy for powdery mildews. But again, what's important is that you started this back in June before the disease got hold.
Make a note for next year.
Right.
Yep. Thanks, Guy. Appreciate the call. Dave and Phillips, you're next. Go right ahead.
Yeah. Hi. I've got a problem with one of my tomato plants. It's the blooms are just drying up on the vine even before they open. And the rest of the tomato plants that I have seem to be doing all right. I just have that one plant that's happening to, and I'm not sure why that's happening. Can you help me with that?
Probably not. You know, this is one of those things that it's really hard to explain. Why is something like this happening? But there could be a variety of things. There could be a little genetic thing going on because, you know, tomatoes are grown from seeds. So who knows? There could be something going on in the roots zone of this plant. So maybe some kind of like wire worms or something have been chewing on the roots so that this particular plant doesn't have as strong of a root system. And so therefore it, you know, it just can't support when it starts doing the blossoms. It's like, nah, I'm not strong enough to actually make fruit, so I'm just getting rid of these flowers. It could be something as simple as when you fertilize that a little too much fertilizer got near those roots and singed those roots, or a woodchuck came through and urinated right there and gave it too high of a dose of nitrogen. I mean, it could be all kinds of weird, silly things, right? Now, it's possible you've got some kind of disease. You know, I mentioned earlier the verticillium wilt, but typically the whole plant kind of gets some wilt in there because what verticillium fungus does is it blocks the vascular system so water can't come up to the whole plant. So you might have a hint of that going on, that sort of thing. So, you know, if your approach would be A, just let it go and see what happens. Maybe it recovers from it. B, I sacrifice that plant. I dig it up. I look at the root system and the stem, look closely at the stem, see if there's any damage on there, you know, from something chewing on it, whatever. If you don't find anything in there, third, send it into Brian Huddleston and the disease diagnostics clinic. You know, it's probably going to cost you $20, but if you're that curious and you really want to know, he can test it for things like verticillium or fusarium or, you know, some of the other things that might cause these symptoms. But it's a tough one to answer because, like you say, with everything else doing fine, you would rule out horrible soil things and pH things or herbicide damage, or, you know, if you're not seeing any insects on there, that sort of thing. Sometimes we just don't know and we can't answer it. So I'm sorry, that's not what you wanted to hear.
But we learned a lot. So thank you for your call, Dave. Speaking about tomatoes, Ellen in Eau Claire emailed us. Apparently they have a small garden, mostly containers, but they do have four tomato plants in the ground. And they're protected by a fenced area because apparently the deer like their containers. Now they get plenty of flowers on their tomatoes, but not much fruit. Last year they got plenty. And this year on four plants, they have maybe eight tomatoes starting. How can they get more tomatoes?
Yeah. So often it's like, oh, what should I fertilize with? What should I do? And usually that's not the answer. And I hate to sound, you know, like I'm giving a cop-out answer, and maybe I am, but blame it on the weather. Okay. So it truly is, if they're getting plenty of flowers, but the fruits aren't forming, something's happening at that point where those flowers are aborting and not forming the fruit. And normally that's due to some kind of stress. So it happened last year a lot when we got those really hot spells, you know, 90 some degrees. We know tomatoes like hot weather, but once it gets above like 86, they are stressed as well. And when it gets, you know, too hot, the plants will abort the flowers. It also happens if it gets too cold. It also happens if it gets too dry. And I'm pretty certain it also happens if it gets too wet. And so, you know, when the soil is constantly wet, the roots aren't getting enough oxygen, and then they don't take up nutrients properly. They don't take up water or nutrients properly. And so then it's a form of stress. And so assuming, since they're getting enough blossoms, that's telling me there's enough light, okay? There's enough sunlight and stuff, but something is making that plant think it can't form fruit, and it's some kind of stress. And again, we may never know exactly what it is, but it's not likely a disease. It's not likely a nutrient deficiency, other than you may have all the nutrients you need in that soil, but the plants aren't able to take it up because it's too wet. And if I can just get off on a tangent on just a second on that, I'm also seeing a lot of things where people are saying they water their garden every day. That's too much. If it's a container, absolutely, you need to water them every day. But in-ground soil gardens do not need to be watered every day. Even if you're on sandy soil, you should only water that if there's no rain. You should only be watering like twice a week and, you know, get the root zone wet. But that soil needs to dry out a little bit in between in order for those roots to get oxygen. And if the soil is always wet, those roots are more likely to get disease in their fungal root rots and stuff like that. And they're more likely to not take up nutrients well, and they're more likely to be a smaller root zone. So people say, well, if I stop watering every day, then the plants will. Well, that's because you've been overwatering, so you have a really small root zone in there. So then if they don't get their daily watering, they're not able to take up enough water and the plant will wilt. And this is, you can really tell this is the case if the plants are wilting in the afternoon and by morning they're perked back up because overnight they're able to replenish that water. So make sure that you stick your finger in the soil and it's dry an inch down before you water, because overwatering, and this year, again, with the rain, we can't but help it, right? But that, I think, is causing a lot of these weird issues of, you know, not forming fruit. And otherwise, I'd say, you know, be patient. Mm-hmm. There's still time. And we didn't get rain this week at my house. But, well, I shouldn't say that this week. I'd say for 4 days. We haven't gotten rain.
For
so
four
maybe
days.
Things have turned.
Yeah, we seem to be getting a lot of rain everywhere. Let's go to Jim in Oshkosh. He has a different question for us. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. So I have a row of Stelladora lilies. Maybe 50 or 60 of them. They're about a foot or two apart. But the last several years, I've been leaving the Creeping Charlie grow, and it's starting to affect the Stelladora. It's just thick in there with Creeping Charlie. I heard your comment a few questions ago about putting down plastic. I heard you can also put down 6 or more inches of wood chips. I'm willing to pull all of that Creeping Charlie out, put down the plastic, and put down the wood chips if you feel that will kill the roots once I pull the plant. Now, I don't want to affect the Stelladora. Oh, what do you think? Would that take care of that if I just keep up with that and keep it covered for the next few years?
Okay, so number one, never put plastic under wood chips. Never do that. That's a recipe for disaster because those wood chips are going to decompose on top of that plastic, and then you'll have a layer of compost and you'll have plenty of weeds in there. So the what you're trying to do is smother the weed seeds, the Creeping Charlie seeds and stuff that are on the soil surface one way or another. So yes, go in there, pull out as much of that Creeping Charlie as you can. Creeping Charlie spreads not only by the rhizomes and the roots, but also by seeds. So pull out as much as you can, okay? And then put down your 5 inches of wood stuff. What that's going to do is smother the weed seeds, the seeds that are still in there, okay? So it's the same thing that the plastic would do, but you don't want the plastic under there. And it's also going to smother the roots of the plants that when you pull them, you know, they break off, right? So some of the roots are still in the soil. They'll sprout back up if they see sunlight. But the 5 inches of wood mulch is going to put them in the dark and keep them from sprouting back. That's the best bet. And I have done this. So I have done this, and it works for the most part. The only thing is that there's always going to be some sneaky little Creeping Charlies that, you know, come back and stuff. So once you do that, like, just keep an eye on it. And anytime you see any little Creeping Charlie leaf popping out, just pick it off of there. And you know, it's you don't want that Creeping Charlie seeing sunlight, because then it's doing photosynthesis and it's growing and it's storing energy in the roots and it's spreading and that sort of thing. But I would go through, pull out as much Creeping Charlie as you can, break it off at the ground as much as you can, then put the thick layer of wood mulch on top to smother things out, and then keep an eye on it and try to keep fighting it back.
Okay, thank you very much, Jim. Our guest today is Diana Alfuth. She's the former UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. What gardening questions are on your mind today? Join by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Make sure you join us on Monday. We're going to be talking about dyslexia, and we're also going to be talking with Jerry Apps. He's going to be turning 90, and we're going to talk to him about his life, his books, and also what his future plans are, because he has them, and he's got a lot more books coming up. So, yay, Jerry. So that'll be fun. But right now, we are talking gardening, and we did get an email, Diana, from Jeff and Barry Mills. He recommends preen for the collar with the weeds in the rocks. He says it needs to be applied a couple of times, but then it works. I've used it. It works pretty well.
Well, so preen is a pre-emergent, so it stops seeds from germinating. It's not going to do anything for the weeds that have already grown in there. And I'm assuming that if her rocks are full of weeds, that there's perennial weeds, grasses, and things like that in there as well. If they were all annuals, they'd all freeze and die this winter, and you know, the problem would be solved. But preen is, you know, it's good to mention, because it is, there are two forms of it. There's a chemical form, and I forget exactly the chemical name in there. It starts with a T. And then there's an organic form, which is basically corn gluten meal. And what it does is, as soon as a seed starts to germinate and it starts sticking out its first little root, it kills it off. And so the seeds don't germinate. So, you know, if she was able to get all those weeds out of those rocks and then put the preen down, that could help with, the, you know, prevent it from getting bad again. And one thing, and I think it was mentioned, is preen, you know, read the label. It's something that you want to put on in spring as soon as the soil starts getting warm, but it usually does have to be reapplied like every 6 weeks or so. So right up until, you know, late summer, there are seeds, weed seeds out there that will be germinating. And so you need that preen to be active when it's needed. Okay. So it's not a one and done thing.
Right. And Jeff, our technical director, said it's trifluralin.
Yeah. I know it starts with a T, but
I know. I'll just forget it. But thank you, Jeff. I appreciate that.
Yes, thank you.
All right. So thank you for that recommendation, Jeff. Another Bill in Oregon also emailed us about the fruitless tomato plants. He said, sometimes it's a lack of pollinators, and if you don't have many other flowering plants in the area, try planting some marigolds around your tomatoes. It works for apartment terrace gardens. And
Actually, that's a really good point, that a lot of times if things flower, like apples, if they flower but don't set fruit, it could be a lack of pollinators. But tomatoes are self-fruitful. They pollinate themselves, and they will typically pollinate each, you know, themselves just by the wind blowing the blossom around, and the pollen falls off and pollinates itself and stuff. It's helped by pollinators, especially bumblebees, because bumblebees shake the flower at just the right frequency to get the pollen going and stuff. But with, you know, with other plants, I would agree that it could be lack of pollinators. With tomatoes, that's not usually the case.
Okay, great. Nancy in Middleton, we're going to go to you next. Go right ahead.
Hi, I have three lovely currant bushes. First year, wonderful currant jelly. Since then, no fruit. And I thought, well, maybe this is an every other year thing. I have to admit, I haven't pruned them. I suspect maybe that's on me.
Yeah, you know, you should still be getting some fruit, even if you didn't prune. And it's, you know, currants don't need like horribly aggressive pruning like grapes do, for example. So, you know, there is the saying, you know, that when you plant a tree or shrub, the first year it sleeps, the second year it creeps, the third year it leaps, sort of a thing. And basically what that means is it does take a long time. It takes at least 3 years for a plant to get established. Now, the fact that you had a lot of currants the first year, that's more surprising to me than anything, because that plant should have been just worrying about building a root system at that point. And maybe that's kind of what happened, is that it spent so much energy that first year producing fruit when it really wasn't ready yet, that it's taking some time to catch up. But the other things that we would want to check is if they're in full sun.
Nancy, are they in full sun?
Yes.
Okay, so that's step number one. Have you done a soil test before you planted or whatever? So do you know like what the pH is, and if you have, you know, any soil deficiencies?
No. Nope.
Okay.
No.
So you know, it they could have fruited the first year because wherever they came from, they had all the proper nutrients and all that sort of a thing, and now it's like, oh, something's a little off. So I would do a soil test and send it into a lab. Don't bother with the over-the-counter things, and find out for sure, because you want to make sure that you have all the proper nutrients and that your pH is right. And remember that if pH is too high or too low, it affects the plant's ability to take up nutrients out of the soil. So then you get nutrient deficiency symptoms, even though there's plenty of those nutrients in the soil. So you want to make sure on that pH, and sending it into a lab is the only way to do it. So I would start with that. You've got full sun. See if anything shows up on the soil test. And if everything is okay on the soil test, then it's a little bit of a, well, let's keep our fingers crossed for next year. Because those would be the, you know, there's not, and this gets a little challenging. There's not like, oh, I'm not getting fruit. What should I fertilize with? Well, there isn't one thing to do that with. And if something's really deficient, that might affect flowering and fruiting. But if, you know, there's going to be a little bit of all of those nutrients in the soils. So you should be able to get at least something, some kind of fruit. So start with the soil test. See what happens.
Okay. Thank you, Nancy. Let's go to Betty in Price County. Go ahead, Betty.
Hi. I have a magnolia tree that we purchased around, shortly after Mother's Day. Beautiful magnolia tree. With all the rain, I'm suspecting that what I'm looking at is a little powdery mildew. I don't know if there's anything that I should do for it. Also, there's some little brown spots on the leaves. There were some bigger ones, and I had read that I should snip those leaves off, and I did. And I burnt them so that they weren't, you know, if it was anything, it wasn't going to continue to pass things around. But do you have any suggestions for me?
My suggestion would be don't panic and don't worry about it. A little bit of powdery mildew, I don't think that's super bad on magnolias, but if you've got like white stuff on the leaves that looks like powdery mildew, that's probably what it is. It's not going to hurt the tree. I wouldn't worry about that at all. A few brown spots, again, I wouldn't go snipping the leaves off. Magnolias are tough. There's not a plant out there right now that doesn't have specks and spots and holes in the leaves. There's still a lot of green leaf tissue there doing photosynthesis, which is exactly what your newly planted tree needs. Don't expect your tree to put on growth this year or next year. Right now it's concentrating on growing a root system, and I would just ignore that powdery mildew and specks on the leaves and just, you know, sit back with your summer beverage and enjoy looking at the tree rather than worrying about it.
Well, if it helps, Betty, I've got a magnolia tree that is in its third year right now, and it is going like crazy after a couple years of just kind of sitting there. So I was a little scared too. So to be patient, be patient. Let's go to Doug in Rice Lake. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Hi, I have a question about rhubarb. I planted rhubarb 5 years ago, and of course I didn't get anything the first year. And I have a lawn service, and I thought they killed it the first year, but it came back. And then they did it the next 2 years, so I fired them. Got a new service this year, and they did exactly the same thing, even though I had told them exactly why the other service had been fired. So my question, though, is, I'm sure it'll come back again, but my question is, will it be safe to eat?
So they're killing it with spraying, not by mowing it off.
No, but with spraying, with the herbicides. I have a Creeping Charlie, too, in the yard. So,
yeah. So, you know, this is a controversial one that, and I'm not a herbicide chemical scientist and stuff, but question number one is what spray they used. Okay, was it 2,4-D or was it dicamba or was it, you know? So that would be step number one to find out exactly what chemical they sprayed on it. Most of the common things that homeowners use are not going to persist in the soil, but the professionals have access to other things that they use. And then you got to find out, you know, like it's quote shelf life in the soil and in the plant. So the herbicides that are usually used work by getting on the leaves and then going down into the root system. I'm not so sure I can answer this as a food safety question. So check with them, find out what they used, and then you'll have to research that compound.
Okay, good luck, Doug. Thank you so much. We're talking with Dinah Alfwith, and we'll be back after the news, so stay with us. This is Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking with Diana Alfuth. She recently retired as the UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. What gardening questions do you have? Are you seeing powdery? I cannot say that today for some reason. Powdery mildew. There we go. Are you wondering how and maybe when to divide a perennial? If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can give us a call. Lines are full right now, but keep it handy. 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Diana, I just wanted to pick up an email that Sue sent us early on. Her tomato plants have septoria and she will be getting very few tomatoes this year, but she's wondering what does she do to make her raised bed where the tomatoes are safe for planting in the future.
Okay, so that's probably septoria leaf spot, which is a common tomato disease, and that's one of them again that it does kind of overwinter on plant debris and in the soil and stuff, and it splashes up onto the leaves in spring. And with all the heavy rains we've had, of course, those raindrops hit that soil at a high rate of speed and they splash it up. And that's how it gets started. So it isn't anything that you cannot like fumigate your soil and clean out your soil or anything like that. That doesn't work. But septoria is not that horrible either. It's definitely manageable. So this is one of the reasons why we usually tell people to rotate crops. So if you rotate and plant like beans there next year, septoria doesn't like beans. So you reduce the amount of it there. But no matter where you're planting tomatoes, the biggest thing is to, as soon as you plant those tomatoes, put down mulch. And my favorite mulch, whether it's in a raised bed or in ground, is a layer of either cardboard or like six sheets of newspaper, and then topped with some straw or dried grass clippings, something like that to basically hold the newspaper down. So you put that straw on like 4 or 5 inches deep. And what that does is it covers the soil so that it can't splash up onto those tomato plants. And then it prevents it from getting going in the year. You might have a little bit of it, but as we talked earlier, a little bit doesn't hurt. It usually starts near the bottom of the plant where the soil is closer, and then it'll work its way up. And usually, you know, frost hits before it works its way all the way up. But that's really the best thing to do. You know, this year, would it help to still put down some mulch? Yeah, because we've got a couple months yet here of soil splashing rains and stuff. But it's not like doomsday. It's definitely manageable.
Okay. Prevention. Right. Mindy in Whitewater, let's go to you next. Go ahead.
Oh, I have hibiscus plants that I bought this season from Walmart. It had quite a few flowers coming on it, and at any given time, there's been up to 10 of them, but none of them have seemed to fully open. And I was wondering if it was getting too much water. I had it outside, and it would seem like with some heavy rain, some of them would fall off after the rain. So I started, bringing it in when it was raining. But do you think that if I pull some of these off, it'll give the other ones a chance to fully open?
I personally wouldn't go pulling them off because the plant knows better than you do which ones should stay on and which ones should come off, okay? Part of what's going on is it might possibly just be the change in location. So they were at Walmart, sure. But now that they're home, they're in, you know, different light, they're in different condition, you know, temperatures, that sort of thing. And anytime that you move a plant, it can send it into a little bit of a shock and stress, and dropping flower buds is one of the most common things that happens when you move a plant. So I definitely would protect it from heavy rains that where the force could be, you know, damaging those buds, that sort of a thing. I would definitely, you know, again, use the finger test, make sure that the surface of the soil is dry before you water. When you water, make sure that you soak that entire root ball, but that way, you know, making sure that it's dry first, you won't be overwatering it. And then I think you got to kind of let it be. And you might lose some more of these flower buds just because, again, when the plant gets a little upset, and hibiscus are a little dramatic, you know, these things happen. But other than, you know, just letting it try to stabilize, I don't know what else you should do.
Now, they like sun too, right? So is that going to make a difference with the blossoms?
Typically, yes, it will. So typically you won't even form blossoms if you're not getting enough sun. But if you're now moving it from full sun into something where it's getting a bunch of shade, that is definitely one of those stressors that I mentioned that would potentially cause it to drop buds.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mindy. Gianni in Montello. Hello, what's up?
Yes. 20 years ago, my mother brought in pampas grass on her property, and now it's starting to spread quite a bit, and even into the garden area. My question is, what herbicide can I use to at least check this spread?
Okay. Yeah, it's probably not technically pampas grass because that's a little more of a southern thing, but it's probably a miscanthus species, which is the ornamental grass. There's a couple different kinds of miscanthus. Some of them don't spread, but there's one that does, and it'll take over whole ditches and everything. You see it a lot. And it spreads by underground roots, and it does indeed get invasive, and that it's very difficult to whack it back without use of an herbicide. And, you know, and you're basically talking Roundup, glyphosate, and it's probably one of those things where it's pretty tall right now, so you don't necessarily want to just like spray these big tall plants, that sort of a thing. If you can mow it off, if it's in an area where it can be mowed, you can, you know, just keep mowing it, mowing it, mowing it, mowing it, and that'll whack it back. Otherwise, if you want to whack it back further, I would mow it and wait until there's a tiny bit of regrowth. And that's the time I would put the herbicide on. The mowing will stress it a little bit. You've got to get that herbicide onto green leaf tissue for it to translocate down into the roots. And obviously always follow the label instructions. Make sure you're dressed with protective clothes on when you spray any herbicide, and only use it as necessary. It might take more than one application because if you've got a big patch of this stuff, you've got a massive root system that has a massive amount of energy stored in it. So it might be something that you do it now and then you do it again, you know, late September. Fall is usually the most effective time for herbicides. And then in spring, you're going to be watching for it to be sprouting back and zap it again then and whack it back. But yeah, it's a challenging one to get a hold of.
Diana, what do you think about putting on things like Roundup with a brush rather than spraying it so you have a little bit more control? Does that work as well?
It can in certain circumstances. So it depends on the area. You definitely risk overspray if, you know, when you're spraying something. Always, you know, make sure it's a calm day. Make sure that you're holding the nozzle low to the ground so that you don't get the overspray. If there is a plant like this pampas grass, if it's growing up like in between your rose bushes and stuff, that's when like a paintbrush or something is the thing to do. So remember that Roundup, 2,4-D, you know, most of the herbicides we use, they do not work by getting into the soil and being taken up by the plants. They work by getting on the green leaf tissue of the plant, going into the leaf, and then down through the vascular system where it also kills the root. So if you get the Roundup or herbicide on just the leaf tissue of the offending weed, it will go down and kill just that, and it won't hurt your other plants. So it can be tricky, but yes, a paintbrush. I know people who will put on a thick rubber glove and then a cloth glove over it and then spray the herbicide on the fingertips of and just wipe it onto the weed. That works very well. It gives you a little bit more control. So depending on the situation, yeah, that's a good option.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks, Gianni. Christina in Wauwatosa, what do you have for us?
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. It seems to be a bumper crop year for me for my hostas. They're just bursting, but they all seem to have holes in them from somebody's eating them. So what do I do?
Most likely it's slugs. Earwigs are also having a banner year. So if you're in an area that has earwigs, they will chew holes in all kinds of things. And this is a great time to remind everybody that if you're finding holes in leaves of a plant, something's eating it. Okay. And if you don't actually see the culprit there, like the Japanese beetle, then spraying it doesn't usually do any good because you have to hit the insect that's doing it. And a lot of times by the time you see the holes, the insects have come, eaten, and moved on in their life cycle. So spraying just because you have holes is usually not warranted. But if you're seeing holes and then the next day you're seeing more holes, but you're not seeing a critter, then I say go out at night with a flashlight and take a look then, because it may very well be a nocturnal thing, which is typically what you're dealing with your hostas. So the slugs come out at night because they don't like sunlight. The earwigs are also active at night, and they'll be climbing on there and eating the holes or eating holes into it. So there are all kinds of, you know, ways to look at it. I mean, it does make, we grow hostas mainly for the foliage, so they look a little ugly when they're looking like Swiss cheese, right? It's not going to hurt the plants in the long run at all. It's just cosmetic. But there are different slug control things. There are the beer traps that you put in where you just bury a thin thing like a tuna can, bury it so that the top edge is at soil level, and fill it with beer, and the slugs are attracted to that yeast and they'll fall in. So you dump it out every morning and refill it with beer, and what kind of beer you use doesn't matter.
Use the cheap stuff.
The leftover stuff. Oh, wait, is there leftover beer? There are commercial slug baits. Make sure that you read them that say they are pet friendly, because there used to be some out that would get dogs sick and stuff like that. So make sure you read the labels. But there are some baits like that. There's a lot of homemade things, like people say, oh, put crushed up eggshells around because they don't like to climb on that. That's garbage. I prove that. I have all kinds of videos of slugs crawling over eggshells. Same with coffee grounds. They're not repelled by coffee grounds. Don't fall for that one. But if you could do something that will make the area drier, so, for example, putting, and I don't want to recommend rocks or that, but like slugs have to stay moist, and that's why they're out at night. So if there was something that caused the area to be drier on the surface, like, you know, theoretically, like little gravel or something, so that the surface, they'd have to be crawling over dry gravel or something like that. But that's not really usually great for a design standpoint or stuff like that. So try some of the traps and baits and that kind of thing. The thing is, again, all this rain, slugs like it wet. And so they are going to be having a fabulous year, whereas last year during our drought year, it was hard to find a slug. So that's probably what you're dealing with.
Okay, thanks, Christine. Lois in Chippewa Falls, you're next. Go right ahead.
Hi. I've had a spider plant for years. It's always been very happy. And this year, as it's blooming, all of a sudden the leaves all turn yellow and kind of a beige looking. It's very weird. And I'm wondering what to do. Should I just cut it back? Do you have any idea what that could be? still blooms.
Are we talking a spider plant, like a house plant spider plant?
Oh, I'm sorry. Spider wort.
Okay. So it might be turning yellow again because of all this rain and because, it might be getting a little root rot or something in there, or just, stressed from the soil being too wet too much. So if a leaf is totally yellow, then or brown, then it's not doing photosynthesis like we were talking about earlier. And so you can cut it out of there and, get rid of it. If stuff is still green, I would not cut it back because those green leaves are still doing photosynthesis and it's the middle of the growing season. If you cut it all the way back, then the plant might shoot back out yet this year, but that's using a lot of energy reserves from the root system. So if it's yellow or brown and there is no green so that it's not doing photosynthesis, you can remove that stuff. If it's still green, I would leave it there. That plant needs to keep growing during the growing season and be doing photosynthesis. And even though it might not look all that great to you, it's going to be better for the plant.
So good luck with that, Lois. Now, so if I want to get rid of some of my spider wort, I should be cutting that baby down, right?
Well, that's the thing. Like, there are some weeds, somewhat like the pampas grass question we had earlier, but things like Japanese knotweed and stuff that, again, a lot of the energy is stored in the roots, so you mow them off, they just shoot right back up. But every time that it shoots back up, it uses some of that energy reserves from the roots. So a lot of cases, one of the ways to get a weed under control is just continuous mowing. As soon as it gets new leaf tissue and starts doing photosynthesis, you mow it off again. I've, whacked out big weedy patches of goldenrod in my hay field or pastures and stuff just by mowing it off 5-6 times during the course of a year, and that stresses it out enough. So remember that the same thing would happen with our landscape plants. If you whack them back, you are causing them stress and you're causing that plant to use some energy reserves to regrow. So we want to maximize photosynthesis. So if it's green during the growing season, leave it be.
Okay. And we've got Aaron in Stoughton who's got a comment for us. Go ahead, Aaron.
Hello. Just another potential comment to consider with regard to the holes in the hosta. I was working with an insurance inspector recently regarding damage to my roof, and he took lots of pictures of my hostas and all the holes that were in the hosta leaves and said that is collateral damage from the hail that hit my house. So just another potential option to consider.
That's a really good point. Hail damage on plants, usually the hailstone goes through the leaf and it leaves like flaps of leaf tissue there, okay? Versus when an insect actually eats and removes leaf tissue. But if you've got hail bad enough, it can actually, knock the leaf tissue down to the ground and then you don't see it and you actually have holes. So that is a very good point. Lots of us have had to deal with some hail this year, but that's great that your insurance adjuster is going to pay you for holy hostas.
Yeah, don't try it unless you've had hail in your area. As the FYI.
So maybe we could get like slug damage insurance, right?
If someone started selling gardening insurance, I think they would make a killing. But
the premium for Japanese beetle damage insurance would be just out
that's
of
true.
Reach.
There would be so many exceptions that you couldn't read the thing. We've got an email from Diane. Her grapevines have set a bountiful crop this year, but they do have two issues presently. They've got Tony galls on the leaves, which she believes is not a serious problem. But the other is that individual fruit are turning black and hard. She did send a picture, and some of the grapes look great, and the others, like she said, are just tiny black and not very inviting looking. So what do you think's going on there?
Yeah, the galls aren't a problem, but the other issue is it's a fungal disease. It's one of the biggest things that vineyards deal with. They monitor all year long looking for it. And I want, I want to say it's called black rot, it's just escaping me right now, but it is a fungal disease and you really should remove those fruits. This is one of those that it can spread. So vineyards, basically they, you know, as soon as they see any signs of it, they walk through the vineyards all summer long and remove it. So this can basically end up ruining your whole crop by the end of the year. So I don't know why I can't remember the name of it, but
she's typing as you can hear.
it is a serious one that you want to get.
Is it just black rot? That's what Jeff found. But just as a reminder that the Learning Store for UW Extension has some really good pamphlets, whatever you want to call it, on grapes. And so that'd be a really good resource to check out.
Yeah, that's a great point. If you just Google UW Extension growing grapes in Wisconsin, there's a book there that, you know, talks about all kinds of things. And this disease will be listed in there. And I think it's called black rot. And it will cause the grapes to kind of like shrivel up and turn black, the individual fruits. Mm-hmm. There are some other things. There's gray mold. There's anthracnose that will also affect the fruits. And again, it's a rainy year. We always have more fungal diseases in a rainy year. So it's going to be a problem statewide.
So is pruning of grape vines important to stop some of that?
Well, pruning of grapevines, when typically we prune grapevines in winter, you know, March-ish or whatever, and grapes need really strong pruning. So you remove most of that plant, and you leave your couple of vines that go out and produce the fruit. Keeping the canopy open so that you get more air circulation in there during the summer could help some. You were probably going to have more of this problem for people like me who don't get out there and prune their grapevines. And so it's just a big old jungle and, you know, down deep inside, oh, look, there's a clump of grapes in there because that holds the moisture in there and the fungus, mm-hmm. the fungi will take hold more. So yeah, pruning unnecessary leaves out of there to increase airflow. There are, again, fungicides that you can look into. And then removing the instances of it. But yeah, it black rot is probably the one. So a little Google search, read about it, see if that matches your symptoms, and then look into the controls that might work for you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Diana. We really appreciate you being with us again. Enjoy the rest of the summer. Diana Alfuth is a retired UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. You know, rock gardens are a beautiful addition to any landscape, but how complicated are they to create and care for? Well, our next guest can give us all the details. With us from Allen Centennial Gardens in Madison, our horticulturist Isaac Zaman and rock garden intern Josh Neslight. Josh Neslight, got the last name right and the first name wrong. Go figure. Do you have a favorite rock garden? Do you have questions about maintaining one? Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Thanks for joining us, gentlemen.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
You bet.
Thank you.
I can tell that you were just out in the garden because you are dressed appropriately with your hat. Absolutely. So, Isaac, what is the official description of a rock garden?
Sure. Our rock garden, specifically the one in Allen Centennial Gardens, is basically a collection of plants that focuses around the hardscape and structure using all different kinds of natural materials, rocks, various different types of low-growing alpine plants, and some small dwarf conifers. We tend to focus on different types of rock garden styles at our garden because we are a teaching garden. So we've got various different implementations within about a third of our 2.5-acre plot. We have everything from like crevice gardens to hyper tufa troughs to just giant tufa beds in our space.
Explain those last two because I have no idea what you were talking about.
Sure. So tufa is actually this awesome stone that you can use in rock gardening. It's a very porous stone that has quite a bit of cavities naturally occurring within the stone. So it actually acts as a great kind of canvas for any rock garden because you can put them very easily into the landscape. They offer a lot of nice structure, but you can also plant into them because they have a lot of spaces. And as for the troughs, my apprentice actually did a bunch of our troughs this past year. So why don't you tell them about that?
All right, Josh, apprentice.
Yeah, of course. So hyper tufa is what it's called, and it's basically a mixture that we make up that is supposed to mimic a tufa rock because they're not found here in Wisconsin. And so they can be very expensive to ship in or just find at like a landscaping store. So what we do is we take Portland cement, perlite, and we also do sphagnum moss, and you mix them together and it hardens and it creates this porous sort of like tufa rock that you can grow plants in just like you would in an actual rock. And it's important to leave those out over the winter and make sure you get the acidity from the cement out because otherwise your plants will not grow well. Yeah, but they are easy to make at home.
Okay, so we would just be able to Google that, I'm assuming, on how to make them.
Yeah, okay. There's plenty of tutorials online, mm-hmm. And it's a really simple process. Like I said, you just mix those three ingredients with some water to get to the right consistency, which is just almost a slurry, but a little bit thicker. And then you put it like around a mold with a plastic bag because you don't want to ruin whatever shape you're making. And you just let it dry for a few weeks and you get a nice trough.
And then you fill them with a certain type of soil?
Yeah, so okay. What we do is we make a mix here at the garden that is sand, gravel, and any sort of like potting soil or leftover soil from other spots in the garden, whatever kind of soil you have. But the main point is that you need sand to make it drain well because rock garden plants are used to an environment where there's a lot of water going in. So like if you think of the side of a mountain, it'll drain down the side, but it won't stay there. So they absorb water while they can, and then the rest goes down the hill. And if you have water that's stagnant, you'll end up rotting out your roots. And so that's why it's important to use torpedo sand, especially, is a great kind.
Okay. And I'm imagining then, Isaac, that's why when we see a rock garden, it is on a hill.
Right. Yeah. In our garden, there are pictures online. If you come and visit us, you'll see that it's quite almost like a giant crater, the entirety of our garden. And the rock garden slopes pretty heavily. We are certainly cleaning up lots of rocks all the time that are washing out with the rain. But it generally also has a very sandy mix, like Josh was saying. I mean, the stuff doesn't look like anything else in the garden. We don't use any mulch there. It's very low fertility, and generally it's always requiring water because the water drains through it so fast. I mean, we can water in the morning and then you go and feel it 3 hours later and it'll be completely bone dry.
So if someone was contemplating adding one to their landscape, that particular point of the water is a big consideration, right?
Right. Yeah. So one of the struggles that we see in the rock garden is that we have very wet soil in some portions. We actually have a sand bed that isn't as sloped as the rest of the beds. So it will collect water and hold it for a little bit longer than the rest. And that is where we see most of our rot and die off, is plants that have just had too wet of feet for their spot, and they just tend to not make it to the next year. They'll look good when we put them in, but then the slow decline.
Sure. Yeah. So Josh, what are your responsibilities at the Rock Garden? What do you have to do to maintain it?
Yeah, so as the Rock Garden apprentice, I spend about half my time here at the garden, just in the Rock Garden. And what I do is mostly watering, like we've been saying, but also weeding. We don't have a lot of weeds that pop up, but when they do, it's almost from the Rock Garden, because certain plants like acetum can be way too happy, and then they spread everywhere in the Rock Garden. And so that's something that I've been fighting back for the 2 years that I've been here. Other things I do, like Isaac mentioned, I have to clean up a lot of rocks because we've been fighting erosion this year with all the rain. So I've always got my shovel out. I got to get the sand and gravel back to the top of the paths. And one other thing we have is a water feature, which is a waterfall that goes into our pond. And it's important that I keep the algae out of there, just for making sure the area looks nice, just because you don't want your garden to be ugly.
That kind of defeats the purpose, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So what, when you decided to become an intern or an assistant or apprentice, were you asked where you would like to focus your energies, or were you just kind of assigned the Rock Garden area?
So I was asked if I would like to work in the Rock Garden, and I was so excited because it was my first real position in the industry that I was like, I just want to work in the garden, so I'll work anywhere. But I really came to love the Rock Garden. I think it's a zen environment. One of my favorite parts is just because everything's so diminutive, you really need to pay attention to detail. And you go in there and there's something new every day. A different plant will be blooming, so you never know what you'll find.
Isaac, how do you decide what plants are going to be put in that Rock Garden, or what are going to be kicked out because they're just not working?
Sure. So it's an interesting thing that I've been thinking about a lot this past year, but essentially for deaccessioning a plant in our Rock Garden, it kind of goes like, if we are not able to properly identify it, either because a label has gone missing or because the plant has been overtaken by something next to it, now it's just this huge amalgamous mass of random things, that is when we will kind of look at it and say, okay, well, do we really want this? Does it look to our standard of what our Rock Garden should be looking like? And if it doesn't, then it's a pretty easy answer for us to just pull that and then replace it with something that we do like. The struggle with Rock Gardens also is that a lot of the nurseries that carry alpine plants aren't producing as heavily as they once were. It's not a market that brings in a ton of money, I don't think. So we actually don't have that many sources that grow them for us. We are almost always ordering by mail from the other side of the country. And even then, there's only like two or three nurseries around. But those nurseries are generally really excited to send stuff to us. So we're really thankful for those nurseries, you know, having things that we get to pick from aside from like the general public. Everything that we get in there is either a curated new cultivar that's being released by some niche breeder, or it's something that, you know, either one of us or one of our rock head volunteers really wants to see in our space, because a lot of our garden, I would feel, is a situation of ownership amongst several different people, right? We work in the garden, but we also have all of these volunteers who are extremely dedicated to the space, and they love being able to come in and add to it and be a part of the design process. So in the Rock Garden, we really boost that as best we can. And our main rockhead volunteer, who actually was on this show about a decade ago, Ed Glover, he actually helps us to, you know, really dial in, okay, this is something really new and rare. We're going to want to get something like that.
So is there like a newsletter for your Rockheads?
Right. So we have a newsletter that goes out to all of our volunteers. The Rockheads are a part of our larger volunteer group, and they usually come on Thursdays from 9 to 11. So they tend to keep in their lane with the Rock Garden, and they always are doing something new and different every week based on like what we have available. Did plants come? Do we want to make some more troughs? And it's very ad hoc, I'd say. But in general, we do also subscribe to NARGS, which is the North American Rock Garden Society. And if you want materials pertaining to rock gardens, you really should sign up for NARGS and get in on their quarterly newsletter, because that will also have a lot of great information, including like how to do the super tufa and how to do all of the various different planting schemes that we have in our gardens.
Great. And again, that was North American Rock Garden, NARG. Okay.
NARGS, yeah, Rock Garden Society. Yep.
Oh, Society. Don't forget the S. Okay. Yeah. So what about, Josh, have you ever tried to do any kind of native planting and for the Rock Garden? Or are we talking about species that really don't grow here?
Yeah, so there's really not a lot going on for natives. Most of the plants we get come from places where there's very poor soil. So that could be like a desert, or even like up in the Arctic in North Canada. It could come from alpine mountainous regions. But one thing that we do have in our rock garden that's native is Wisconsin's native cacti. And so that's one thing that I think a lot of people, when you tell them that, they might not have heard of it before. So Wisconsin has cacti native. You know, it just doesn't really sound right, but it is. We have, like Isaac was talking about, a sand bed, which is supposed to mimic more like a desert environment. And so when that became too wet, we had to move our cacti underneath our gazebo. Like there's a little overhang, and that way it keeps the soil from being too wet.
I imagine they loved it last year and are hating it this year.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, with us from the Allen Centennial Gardens in Madison are horticulturist Isaac Zellman and rock garden intern Josh Neslett. If you've got any questions for them, give us a call. Lines are open, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email. That's talk@wpr.org. Hope you can join us on Monday. We're going to be talking about how a boy with dyslexia went from not reading at 18 to getting his PhD. And then we'll chat with our old friend Jerry Apps about his life, his books, and turning 90. So that'll be coming up on Monday. Hope you can join us again. Right now we are talking about rock gardens. And I was just, you know, for those who haven't been to the Allen Centennial Gardens, there's more there than just the rock garden. So tell us a little bit about some of the things that you have, Isaac.
Sure. Yeah. So we're a 2.5-acre teaching garden on the UW-Madison campus, sort of by the Lakeshore Nature Preserve. We specialize as a teaching location for all of the different plant-based majors and departments on campus, everything from like horticulture, botany, to landscape architecture, and even history and arts. We have 27 different garden styles that we try to keep and maintain to be able to teach to all of our students. But we also do all sorts of events and fun things at the garden. So we've actually got some jazz concerts coming up in the next 3 weeks on July 21st, August 4th, and August 18th. Those are completely free and they are on Sunday. We also have make your own bouquets during that around 4 o'clock on Sundays. And we also have other fun things that we do in the garden in the fall, like our annual harvest festival, which is going to be on the 28th of September this year. And we're also bringing to the garden awesome fun summer Saturdays, which has bouquet making and tours that are $10 and $5 respectively every Saturday from 9:30 to 11.
And normally it's free to go in. It's just that you'll have an expert tour person or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So if you visit the garden any time of the week, you can just have a fun time, walk around, although you may not get to hear everything about all of the spaces. But if you want one of our interns or one of our staff members to kind of walk you around and show you around and give you the inside details about like the teaching that goes on or all of the various different projects that we have happening, then that'll all be during the weekends.
For sure. And I've been a number of times, and I swear every time I go, I find something different. It's like, I'm sorry, I don't remember there being a garden back there. It's beautiful.
Yeah. I really like to mix it up.
Yes, you do. So I was just thinking about, you talked about earlier about name tags and how frustrating it is when you go to a botanical garden and there's no little nameplate there. How do you keep track of that? And are there special ones that you buy for that? Go ahead, sure. Isaac.
Sure. Yeah. So we've got tons of different ways of managing our collections, but one of the useful ones is our plant finder. So if you go on our website and you go into the about area of our website, you'll be able to find our database, which kind of breaks up the garden by the different sections, and it has our plant lists in it. So we've been working diligently to update that since COVID and get a bunch of new plants in, take old plants out. And we also do physical labels as well on a lot of our woodies, as well as a bunch of the really niche stuff that's in the rock garden. So for everywhere else in the garden, we tend to use bigger labels that are just for the larger plants, you know, woody shrubs, trees, and et cetera, annuals. They change too much to have everything labeled.
True.
But in the rock garden, Josh has actually been taking care of a lot of our labeling with the tiny, smaller labels to fit with the tiny, diminutive plants.
Because you don't have a lot of soil to be putting little, you know, signs in, do you?
Right.
No, there's not. And the rock heads, when they first helped to make the space, they did a really good job at making the crevices. And so I'm sitting there sometimes with these labels, poking them in the ground, just looking for a single hole to get the stake into. But it's tough without as much soil.
Right. And I just didn't even really think about that. So what advice do you have someone who wants to have a rock garden, whether it's something big on a slope or maybe it's like a little trough like you were talking about? Where do you start first?
Yeah. So the first thing I would look to do is see if you can get any tufa rock, because that is by far the best kind of starting point you could get for a rock garden. It is expensive and it can be hard to find.
And how is that spelled? How is that spelled, Josh?
T-U-F-A.
Oh, just like it sounds. Okay, tufa. Great. Thanks.
And so if you can't find that, there's plenty of alternatives. Like I said, you can grow these plants in just a mixture of gravel, sand, and any normal soil. You just want to have rocks because they help to support the plant. Since there's not a lot of soil, they don't have a lot of roots to like keep themselves down on the ground. But that's part of why they're diminutive, is to keep out of the wind and like to stay warm in the winter. One other thing you can do is you can take like long, thin rocks. And Isaac kind of alluded to this earlier. We have a crevice garden, and the crevice is a bunch of like normal rocks that you'd put in. Think like, if you load your dishwasher with a bunch of plates,
okay,
you have all these thin little spots where you can put plants into the ground. And those create like a kind of micro habitat. So you can even plant things that like typically alpine plants like full sun, but you can plant things like ferns in your crevice that require shade, because as the sun goes across the sky, like this slanted crevice will keep it shaded all day. And so there's lots of different styles. And then, like I was talking about before, you can make the hyper tufa troughs, which are really pretty cheap to make. Like it's only will run you $20 probably to make a trough. And you can, if you have a bag of cement and perlite and peat moss, like you can make probably 50 of them. that's a huge scale, like rock garden. So
do you make the shapes into like just regular troughs like you would see like to feed an animal, or are you talking about weird shapes and things like that?
Yeah, so there's what we do at the garden is our troughs tend to be either rectangles, squares, circles, or ovals. But there are people out there that I know who create like free form ones where they use sand as a mold, and so then they like make a design in the sand and then cover it up with a plastic bag and pour the mixture over the top of it. And that way you can get like a star or something crazy, you know? Mm-hmm. So it can, it's really, rock gardening can be up to your imagination for sure.
Yeah.
Like the sky is the limit.
I like that. I don't noticed on your website that you did a like a tour of some rock gardens in the area. And what did you what was your thoughts on that? Did you have one that was your favorite?
That's tough because they're all so great. But the rock gardens that I went and saw were all owned by like just normal people who were passionate about the kind of gardening. And I'd say my favorite one was just in someone's backyard in Milwaukee. And you wouldn't have known it from the front yard because it just, it's like a small house, you know, they're all packed together kind of in a row. But when you enter the backyard, you're like transported into this totally different world where like they have like a waterfall and a huge pond and like a bridge over it in their backyard. They have all these unique plants. And it's just, it's something that you wouldn't know is there unless you got into it and you started talking to the people who are passionate about it as well.
Isaac, what do you do in the winter to protect some of these plants? I mean, if they don't have long roots, what goes on in the wintertime?
Well, I actually am not worried about the cold because like Josh was saying, a lot of these plants come from regions where they have harsh conditions. And they are not actually that hard to grow in Wisconsin. Just because we have some milder weather in comparison to like the top of a mountain. But we also have constructed our garden with a lot of rock faces that are out of the soil. And they are extremely good heat sinks. So when the sun comes out in the winter and it's hitting these rocks perfectly fine, it'll actually melt the snow. So all these plants are actually doing completely fine. We rarely have issues with hardiness. We have plants that are up to zone 6 and even sometimes zone 7 in our crevice garden, and they're doing just fine. They're actually thriving, growing, producing seed. So I don't do anything other than deal with the moles and voles. So we put out a couple of traps, but that's really all we have to worry about. And because of the mild winter this past year, we actually didn't have much activity. So
That's always nice. Josh, if you so say I wanted to start a rock garden, what plants would you suggest that I start with, and is there a location in a garden that would be the best?
So probably the best location would be on some sort of hill if you have that. And if you just have like a flat yard, I would suggest making a hill. So just like by piling up your soil and your rocks, you can kind of make an incline where you can plant these plants. And I would say for a beginner, I would start with some things like sedums or hens and chicks, pasque flowers. These are really easy to grow. They'll spread a lot on their own, and they can grow in lots of different conditions. They are so good at growing that, like I was saying, they kind of become weeds in our garden at certain points. You know, we have to declump them because otherwise they take over the rest of the rock garden.
Isaac, I didn't ask you, do you have a favorite rock garden somewhere?
Oh, goodness. Well, I have to say ours, right?
Of course, besides but that one.
Certainly. I do like rock gardens and personal homes. One of my friends, Jane Barnett, has a wonderful rock garden all on her property. She lives here in town. I actually got a chance to go over there while all of the NARGS members were over there hanging out. And so we were all just geeking about all of these plants. It was quite awesome. But if you're ever looking to get any of these rock garden plants, I would say mail order is probably the best way to go. There used to be some places in Madison that you could get them, like the Flower Factory. Sometimes they sell them still at the farmer's market, but generally speaking, go online and probably anywhere that has rock garden in the name.
All right. Well, thank you both very much. We've been talking to Isaac Zaman and Josh Neslett. They work with the Allen Centennial Gardens. Thanks, guys. Have fun out there in the sun today. And I'm Jill Nadeau. I want to thank you for joining us today and thank all of our team for all of their help. Stay well.